It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Contract talks are scheduled to resume this week between the United Steelworkers Union and Allegheny Technologies Incorporated. ATI has locked out roughly 2,200 workers at 12 plants in Pennsylvania and five other states. A key sticking point in the negotiations is the company's demand that workers begin paying some of their health insurance premiums. Labor leaders and union supporters see this as another slap in the face to workers. Vice President Joe Biden was in Pittsburgh yesterday, taking part in the annual Labor Day parade, and in a speech, he addressed what he called a national war on organized labor and exhorted Western Pennsylvania's union workers to keep fighting.
Our job is one thing, all of you, to make sure every parent can look their kid in the eye, knowing they put in a full day's work and say, honey, it's gonna be okay. That's what labor's about. That's what unions are about.
I'm joined now by phone from Washington by journalist Philip Dine, a labor expert and author of the book State of the Unions. Philip Dine, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you belong to a union? Are you a business owner or a manager who oversees union employees? What is the nature of labor relations where you work? How much power should unions have, and what is their impact on the economy? You can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email ESSPGH at WESA.FM on Twitter at ESSPGH. Philip Dine, what do you make of Vice President Joe Biden's comments about a national war on organized labor?
Well, it's a very interesting question. I think he's absolutely right. Labor in this country actually began its decline. Its high point was in the mid-50s, the late 50s, when it was about 33% of the workforce. It's been declining gradually ever since, but that gradual decline became a precipitous decline after 81, when Ronald Reagan broke the Air Traffic Controllers Union. And what that did was send out a message to employers that the old rules didn't apply. They could get tough and aggressive with unions. And that happened mostly in the private sector, and we saw membership decline over the next couple of decades. But then a few years ago, we had sort of a perfect storm with the Great Recession and with taxpayers being really hurt. And we also had, at that point, public sector unions, because of what I just mentioned, were the strongest and growing part of the labor movement. So some folks saw this as a perfect opportunity to strike a blow at the heart of labor, the public sector unions. But by purporting to represent hardworking taxpayers, we've got to cut government, we've got to destroy the public sector unions. We've seen that in Wisconsin and many other states. So there absolutely is now a war on organized labor. At the same time, I just want to add one more thing. A lot of labor is not very happy with the administration of Joe Biden and Barack Obama, because on a couple of major points, especially trade, but also the ability of workers to form a union and legislation that would help that, the administration has sort of waffled or actually been opposed to labor. So there's a little bit of a mixed record there in labor's eyes.
Well, certainly Joe Biden, he's made it pretty clear that when he got his start in running for the Senate in the early 70s, that he could not have done it without union support. He probably has to go along with what President Obama does, and a lot of times he will take the middle road when it comes to divisive issues like this. Is Joe Biden saying that, and I don't want to make this all about him, but is he saying that, you know, I'm the guy who's going to stick up for the unions? What should we understand about why the vice president is so fired up about all this?
Well, I think you raise a really good point. It reminds me a little bit of about 40 years ago when Ewart Humphrey was serving Lyndon Johnson and ardently supported the war in Vietnam publicly, but privately against it. I think you raise a good point. I think Joe Biden is more of a blue-collar type guy, less cerebral, less of a professorial type. And I do think he understands what labor is about and is instinctively supportive of it and wouldn't mind their support.
Now he also said yesterday, and I'll quote from him, that there's a simple correlation. Build labor, we build America. Build America, we build the middle class. Is that oversimplifying it? Do you agree with his assessment? Or what can we take from his assessment that makes it, that would make sense to an economist?
Well, you know, I think he's got a point. If you just look historically, I don't think it's any, well, it doesn't seem to be any coincidence that in those periods of American history, when labor's been strongest, the American middle class has been growing, i.e. from the late 40s, post-war, late 40s to the mid-70s. We had an expanding labor movement, and we had an expanding middle class. Since then, especially the last couple of decades, we've had a shrinking middle class and an assault on labor, and that's no coincidence. I would add, I think that it's a fairly easy case to make, what the vice president said, and labor hasn't always done a very good job of making that sort of macro case of why a strong labor movement is in the national interest, not just the interest of union members.
Some of the statistics that Joe Biden cited, and we'll do a little fact-checking with you, Philip. In the 70s, he says 1% owned 20% of the wealth. Today, 1% owns 40% of the wealth. That in the 70s, the CEO made 25 times the salary of the average employees. Now the CEO makes 400 times as much. Are we seeing the financial gains unions have made for their members being rolled back? And are these figures, do they add up?
I think the latter might be a bit inflated. I've seen figures of 296 times or 300 times the average employee, but that's sort of quibbling about details. There's some companies where the CEO makes 2,200 times. In any case, the bottom line, whatever the exact figure is, that the typical CEO earns more before lunch on the first day of the year than his average employee will throughout the year. And not only looking historically at our country is that a dramatic change, it's a stark contrast with the rest of the world. This doesn't happen elsewhere. And what used to be unique about America is we had a really strong middle class. We didn't have what we have now, which is the rich getting richer, the poor getting poorer, and a shrinking middle class. And that's not just a cliche. That is actually what's happening. And that doesn't inure to the benefit of anybody long run, including corporations and the wealthiest, because they need people who can, as Henry Ford, for all his faults, long ago understood, companies need workers who can actually buy the products they make.
We're talking with Philip Dine, who is a journalist and a labor expert. He is the author of the book State of the Unions. And if you want to join our conversation, 412-246-2002 is the number to call. Again, 412-246-2002. We'd like to hear from people who deal with union employees, who run businesses or are managers of businesses, as well as those of you who might be in a union and would like to give us some feedback about what you're experiencing, what you're seeing out there. 412-246-2002, the number to call, and we're on Twitter at ESSPGH. Let's go to the phones. We have Jim from Monaca who wants to join the conversation. Jim, hi. How are you?
Fine. How are you, Phil? I just wanted to say, I thought Vice President Joe Biden was just pandering to the labor crowd yesterday. A lot of the troubles that the steelworkers are having with the contractor are due once again to the ever-increasing amounts of imports coming into this country, and they've had plenty of time as his administration, as well as those in Congress, to do something about this, and they simply won't. You know, and just to tell us, you know, well, the union membership, this and that, you know, it's not getting the job done. And as many times as we've told them this, and I think Rich Strumka has told them this too, but, you know, why they keep re-inviting these folks, I don't know. You know, I'm suspect as to whether he'd even be, it would have been here yesterday if he wasn't planning on running for president.
Well, I mean, you make a point, Jim. Certainly the vice president is a politician who may well be making yet another run for him for president. But as we talked about earlier, Phil, the vice president sounded, he sounded genuinely upset about the situation that unions find themselves in today.
I think he is. At the same time, I think the caller has a valid point, as I said at the outset, because on the existential questions, as Labor sees it, the Free Choice and Free Choice Act, which would have streamlined. Right now, it is harder to form a union in this country than in any democracy in the world. People don't know that, but it's true. It's true because, A, of employer aggressiveness, and B, because of the labyrinthine labor laws we have. It is extremely hard to form a union. And about 30,000 workers a year under Republican and Democratic administrations are fired or disciplined for trying to exercise their lawful rights to form a union. That used to be a few hundred in the 50s. It then went up to a few thousand. It's now that figure. If that were happening in South Africa or Poland, it would be front page news. It's happening here, and nobody even knows it. And the point is, those are the workers. About 30,000 a year, 30,000 workers a year have the wherewithal to challenge and fight through the NLRB and actually win the case on the national level. Think of those who don't have the resources and wherewithal, and then think of the chilling effect that has on millions of workers in this kind of economy. So that was something that Barack Obama supported as a senator and pledged to sign into law as a president. Now, it's obviously not his fault that the Congress won't go along with that, especially the other party, but nonetheless, he's been fairly mute on it. And the other thing is trade. So I think that while Joe Biden's heart is in the right place as far as labor sees it, they do have a problem, as the caller suggests, with what the administration's track record.
You spoke earlier, Phil, about the 1981 air traffic controllers, I believe it was PATCO was the union that Ronald Reagan was upset with because they went on strike, and he said, "If you go on strike, we're going to replace you. We're going to bust your union." Essentially, did that episode kind of create the playbook for businesses and for governments, state governments, perhaps in coming years, to use that as the way to break a union?
Yes. And more than the playbook, it set a tone that the old rules didn't apply. In the past, unions and labor and management regarded each other as maybe necessary evils or as part of the system. You know, you had labor management government. We had a tripartite industrial relations system that for decades contributed to our economic prosperity and political stability. Nobody always won, nobody always lost, but everyone was at the table. People's voices were represented. After that, management got the message all that didn't need to apply. We could look short term. We could do what we had to. We could not just challenge unions on their demands. We could try to destroy them, to get rid of them. So one of the few growth industries in this company is union avoidance. Multi-billion-dollar industry where consultants now explain to companies how to avoid having a union. And the best way to win a union election is to avoid having one in the first place from their perspective. So we have employers. Most of them obey the law, but they come right up to the limit. Some don't, as I alluded to before with the 30,000 figure. So we've got now companies not just trying to limit the power units, but trying to get rid of them. And now that they've hardly succeeded in the private sector and gone to the public sector, you hear a lot of companies and conservatives say, at least the private sector unions were legitimate because it's not incestuous like it is with public sector where you have unions helping elect politicians and then bargaining with them. So what's kind of ironic there is after successfully trying to almost rid the marketplace of private sector unions, suddenly those private sector unions were actually all right. It's these public sector ones we got to go after. So that did definitely set the tone, but then again, that was up the notch during the Great Recession when we had the, strapped taxpayers, strapped local, state governments, federal governments, and a perfect opportunity for whether it's political, economic, or ideological conservatives to say, now we got to go after these folks so we can do it purportedly on behalf of the American public.
412-246-2002 to join the conversation with our guest journalist and labor expert, Philip Dine. Let's go to Evan from Armstrong County. Evan, you're on Essential Pittsburgh. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I just was listening to your show, and I wanted to state my opinion. My biggest problem with unions is, and not all unions, but the rhetoric, the political rhetoric, always is associated with the middle class and them getting paid higher wages. But the biggest problem, I think, is when you pay them these higher wages, higher than the market rate, eventually these are passed on through the supply chain to consumers. And everyone is a consumer. Not everyone's in a union. So a small amount of people are benefiting from these uncompetitive wages, whereas everyone is eventually going to suffer. You know, if they're in the steel union, the price of steel goes up, or if they're, in the boilermakers union, the price of power is going to go up. The supply, it's not like these companies just take these costs and keep them internally. They pass on a portion of them to the consumer. And I think sometimes that point is missed because, like with electricity, a lot of these consumers are lower class or middle class people, and that's not talked about. It's only talked about in wages.
Well, go ahead, Philip.
No, I think that's a fair point in theory, but in practice, a couple of things. One is that many of these companies who plead poverty, who say they can't raise wages for exactly the reasons the caller just mentioned, give huge raises in the tens of millions of dollars to their management team. At the very time they're saying they can't give it, they have to cut the wages of the workers. So I don't know how those two things square. And then secondly, a lot of companies find that when they raise their workers' wages, or at least don't go to war with the workers, because again, one thing in a lot of these contract things, unions are not actually asking for more. Unions would sort of accept a status quo with maybe a cost of living adjustment. It's often the companies that are saying, we need to slash dramatically this, we need to cut your benefits. They're the ones seeking to change things. I'm not saying they're wrong to do so. I'm just saying it's not necessarily the unions. Unions are somewhat realistic, not always. They make mistakes, overreach sometimes, but they essentially know the economy we're in and the leverage they have. So they're not really demanding huge increases. And a lot of companies find that when they actually pay their workers fairly, they have less turnover, they have happier workers, they save money in recruitment and training because they have stability in the workforce, they treat their better customers better, and they actually do better. That's why some companies, retail companies, voluntarily pay well over the minimum wage because they think it helps them in the long run.
412-246-2002 is the number to call. Philip, I wanted to ask you about, to the point you just made, and as it specifically relates to what's happening at ATI, U.S. Steel wants its employees to pay premium costs for health care benefits, an annual deductible starting at $2,600, and eliminate policies for Medicare-eligible retirees. Other businesses have gotten these concessions from their employees. They, you know, it used to be that they took care of your health care. Now the employees have to pay in. So why is this such a big deal? If for the average person looking at this situation, aren't they saying, wouldn't they look at this and say, you know, I have to pay for part of my health insurance. Why shouldn't these union folks have to do the same?
Well, I think you're right. I think a lot of people do say I have this problem or that problem or this payment, and why shouldn't unions? The whole point of a union is, to represent workers and try to get a decent deal for them. When unions function well and don't overreach, that's what they do. They don't try to bankrupt the company because that would be, killing them their jobs in the long. What they try to do is have reasonable compensation and benefits that they bargain for. And often when they get decent pensions or benefits, as you just mentioned, it's because they've compromised. They say, okay, we won't demand a wage. We don't want a wage increase, but give it to us in this sense. So it's not as simple as then, okay, let's just change the one aspect we gave you something on and everything will be good. So I think it's a complex, and again, these contracts are signed by both parties. Both agree to them, and so it's hard just to change one aspect. But more broadly, I think that the steelworkers feel that, especially with ATI, this is really a war. This is different than in the past because, again, this is in their view, reflective of a desire to destroy the union, to lock them out, even when they're saying they'll continue to work if while discussions continue. So I think labor feels that it's fighting for its life. It's taken it on the chin for too long. The economy is coming back. Workers are more productive than ever, and yet their wages are declining. And as a lot of economists have pointed out, you know, productivity and wages went hand in hand for decades. It's only a couple of decades ago when those two started diverging. And that's, to get back to your point about labor and jobs and middle class, that's just when the middle class, when labor started declining. And I think labor's biggest issue, biggest challenge is not any specific piece of legislation, not any specific contract negotiation. In my view, and that's what I argue in the book, labor's biggest challenge is to get out the message to people that the decline in labor and what people see all around them, which is a shrinking middle class and foreclosures and unemployment, all these dramatic problems are related. There's a link between what's happening in labor and what's happening in the middle class. If labor can make that case, it'll thrive. If it doesn't, it's going to be very difficult.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and my guest is journalist Philip Dine, a labor expert, author of the book State of the Unions. We're talking about union issues. We're looking at what's happening with the union workers, the United Steelworkers union members being locked out by ATI, those negotiations scheduled to continue this week. We'll talk more about that. Phil Dine, can you stay with us for another segment? And we'll also take your calls. We have Joanne holding from Sewickley. We'll take your tweets. We'll get to all of that as we continue on Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.
And everybody's saying, this is a union town, a union town. All down the line, this is a union town, a union town. All down the line, and if they come to strip our rights away.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are discussing labor union issues. We had a fiery speech from Vice President Joe Biden supporting unions, talking about the tradition of unions and how they, in his view, support and expand the middle class. Business owners would tell you differently, and right now we're seeing a conflict between the United Steelworkers Union and Allegheny Technologies Incorporated. ATI has locked out over 2,000 workers at their 12 plants in Pennsylvania and other states. The negotiations are scheduled to resume this weekend. Where will they go? What does this mean? And how will it impact the future of labor relations and the strength of unions in the country? 412-246-2002 to join the conversation with our guest, Philip Dine, who is the author of the book State of the Unions and who is a labor expert. We have Joanne from Sewickley, who's been waiting patiently. Joanne, thanks for holding. You are on the air with Philip Dine.
Thank you. I was listening to your guest comments about benefits, and I really think that that plays a lot into maybe the decrease in support of the general public that are not unionized, because I think the general public has been paying part of their health insurance benefits for a while, and some people very significant parts of their benefits. So when they hear a main point of a union conflict is they expect us to pay part of our health insurance benefits, people think, well, I've been doing this for years, and, you know, why shouldn't they be paying part of their benefits? I think it's just a lot of their issues is in pensions. Non-unionized places of work have pensions are gone. There are no more pensions. You're expected to do your own retirement in a 401k, and if you're fortunate enough to work for a company that is generous in contributing to that, you know, you're good. So to hear, you know, they're cutting our pension or we're expected now to pay something for our health benefits, I really think it's wearing away public support for unions in general.
Joanne, before Philip responds, I would ask you this: if you were in a situation where your benefits, where suddenly your employer was telling you, you know what, Joanne, you're going to have to pay for your own health benefits from now on, and you had a union step in for you and say, no, we're not going to let that happen, would you feel differently?
Probably, but I've been paying a significant part of my benefits for many years because it's I work in a medium-sized establishment, and every year Human Resources has a meeting and they explain to us how much insurance coverage is going up every year, and every year our part that we have to put in goes up also.
Okay, so Joanne, so Philip, what about the point that Joanne is making, the fact that businesses are saying to their employees, look, we can't make the profits that we've made in the past, business is not affordable for us to do without some mitigating of the payout of these benefits. And why shouldn't the union employees have to make the same concessions that probably the majority of American workers are now making?
Well, yeah, again, and there too, I think Joanne reflects what a lot of people think. But what I'd say is this. And I'm sure she's right. I'm sure it is the case that more and more non-union companies are paying fewer benefits or no benefits at all. But first of all, it's not the case that the union workers are saying we don't want to pay anything, any co-pays or deductibles. They already are. What's happening is the companies want to dramatically increase the cost of the employees. But secondly, yes, it's true that a lot of companies are doing this with non-union employees, but that's directly a result of what I was saying. As the union influence and power in this country has declined, see, one thing that used to happen in the past was that even if you weren't in a union, you benefited from a strong union movement because companies wanted to remain competitive in seeking employees. So when unions represented 35, 37% of the workforce, and sometimes much higher in a given industry, other companies had to match that or even do better if they wanted their workers not to join a union. So all employees benefited from that. When Jim Hoffa of the Teamsters, had negotiated national contracts with the truck industry in the 50s, he brought millions of Americans into the middle class because of the ripple effect. Now, as labor's declined, Joanne's absolutely right. Companies say, we don't have to worry about those unions. They're so weak. And we can do all these things to prevent our employees from forming a union. So we're going to offer very little.
Let me ask you this. Earlier, Philip, pardon me for interrupting, but you mentioned earlier in our conversation, you talked about unions overreaching. Was what happened with the Reagan administration in the early 80s, was that a response to an overreach by the unions to a situation where the unions in this country had become so powerful? And I don't think there's anybody that would argue, certainly at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, that unions were something that workers needed. They needed representation. But did they get to the point where they became so powerful that they hamstrung businesses and made it very difficult for businesses to do their thing and make their money?
I think that did happen in some instances. Unions have several problems. One is that they sometimes overreached. Another is that they often introduce I talked about labyrinthine labor laws. Well, the same could apply often to work rules. They often hamstrung management's flexibility. I mean, some of it's a matter of degree. I mean, they probably went overboard in some instances. And then in some rare cases, it's overblown sometimes, but there's also corruption in unions. So most of that is pretty much been eliminated now. I mean, the corruption that exists now is more in the corner suites than in the union halls. But you're absolutely right. The unions did overreach. And I think Ronald Reagan, I'm not saying he didn't have some justification legally in terms of that specific, it's questionable whether the air traffic controllers had the right to strike. So I think he and others also brought an ideological approach to the fight, not just attacking overreaching, but rather, hey, this is an opportunity to stick it to unions, not just to get tough again on negotiating, but to actually call into question their right to exist, as Scott Walker recently has done in Wisconsin. Because when he said we got to curtail bargaining rights of the unions because they're demanding too much, the biggest public sector unions immediately agreed to not seek demands that went beyond what he wanted. And he wouldn't take yes for an answer because his goal was to strike at the very heart of union existence, public sector union existence, which is the right to collectively bargain.
We have let me jump in.
The answer to your question, yes, you're right, but there's more to it than overreach.
Let's go to David in Braddock Hills, who wanted to express some concerns about the aforementioned Scott Walker. And David, you're on with Philip Dine. Hi.
He mentioned the Scott Walker thing. I was concerned about him also. I mentioned that you guys brought up Biden and unions. But Scott Walker is the real issue because he's already running for president. Biden has never announced presidency yet, but Scott Walker, he's already running for president, and he wants to do what exactly the opposite. He wants to actually remove the bargaining power from unions, and which is going to take the middle class into an opposite direction and remove the bargaining power and make it a more like a right-to-work country instead of a right-to-work state.
David, you're making a good point. I want to jump in because we're getting tight on time. Philip, is Scott Walker gaining any traction with that issue? I mean, he was able to do a lot of devastation when it came to unions in Wisconsin, but on the national stage, is what he has said and what he is doing or has done resonating with people?
Not as much as he had hoped, for a couple of reasons. One is that union membership is an important issue for Republicans, conservatives, or unions, but it's not the uppermost issue right now with all the national security issues and so on. And the second problem he faces is Donald Trump, who has taken all the oxygen out of the room except for the most bombastic, the people like a Jeb Bush possibly or Ben Carson who have a real personality or supporters. For the middle-level people like Scott Walker, he's finding it tough to get any attention now for reasons that are not his fault and that really don't do with his issue, but more with Donald Trump, I think.
Let's go to Joe in Pleasant Hills, who has a comment. Joe, hi. We're tight on time, so be as quick as you can if you would.
Yeah, briefly, I am retired now, but I've seen both sides of the equation. I was in the union, and then I was an industrial salesman, and I saw the companies. And briefly, for every two unions that do overreach and they support people who should be fired and they don't get fired because the union protects them, for every two unions that are faulty and bad, there's 20 companies that will take advantage to the extreme of their employees. And most of the people listening who are anti-union worked for companies that had to give them health coverage, that had to give them 2 weeks vacation, that had to give them a 40-hour work week, and had to give them overtime. The unions absolutely did build the middle class. There were problems with them. There are still some of them, I'm sure. But I've traveled through the South and through the West and in companies that had contracts and so forth, and trust me, companies will screw you down to the floor and put a rug over you.
Well, Joe, I think you've covered a lot of the history of unions and labor relations in the United States. With that comment, let's go to Gene in Pittsburgh. Gene, go ahead. You'll be our last. Well, we lost Gene. Let's go to our tweets. Olivia on Twitter says she thinks shareholders are being greedy. She says more money for them, less for workers equals a very unbalanced scale of wealth. Jan on Twitter says management has pitted union members against future workers with two-tiered wages. Members vote to allow lower wages for new workers. We're just about out of time, but Philip, let's have you address that before we wrap this up.
I think your callers were spot on. Joe summed up far more eloquently than I could what I've been trying to say. And one last thing. For folks who say that corporate profitability and unions don't go hand in hand, some of the most successful sectors and companies in this country, aerospace, for example, with Boeing or Lockheed Martin, a wall-to-wall union, the biggest brewery in the world until recently, Anheuser-Busch, wall-to-wall union. Those companies think that unions, when unions function well, actually help the bottom line because they introduce sort of uniformity throughout the work floor. They introduce a grievance process. There's procedures, so you're not dealing with every worker individually. So when unions and companies function well, as they used to, together, and each accept the other, companies can profit and workers can do well.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens with the ATI lockout situation. In the meantime, it's been an interesting conversation with our guest, journalist Philip Dine, a labor expert and author of the book, State of the Unions. Philip Dine, thank you so much for being with us today on Essential Pittsburgh.
My pleasure. Enjoyed it.
Coming up, we will look at how Pittsburgh is going to become Britsburg starting today and for the next week. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.
There's power in a factory, power in the land, power in the hand of the worker. But it all amounts to nothing if together.